Hi, and welcome back to the Mob Mentality Show. We have our guest here with us, Joshua Kirievsky, and I'm Chris Lucian, and this is Austin Chadwick, and so welcome to the show. And I wanted to kick it off a little bit with maybe an introduction for yourself and what you do, and then dive into a interesting topic of multi-mobbing. So can you give a quick introduction and then maybe explain to us the concept?
Sure, I'm Josh Kirievsky of Industrial Logic, and I'm the CEO and founder of the company. Been around the lean and agile world for a couple of decades now, and happy to be here.
Awesome. And so you do mobbing from time to time with clients and among your own software development as well.
Yes.
And then you also maybe you can get into a little bit of that. What types of mobbing have you been involved in and your company's been involved in? And then what does it look like with multi-mobbing?
Yeah, sure. So we first started adopting mobbing. We have a somewhat distributed team in our company, so we would do virtual mobbing. Mm-hmm. In the early days, and a few people would be local, but then there'd be some remote folks. So, you know, we would use desktop sharing software and things like that.
Any favorites?
Well, there was the tools come and go because they get acquired and they get baked into things. So it constantly changes.
Right.
But Zoom sometimes these days, or you know, Hangout, or we used to use ScreenFlow, but it got acquired by Slack, and so sometimes we have used Slack. For some of these things, various.
Okay. Yeah.
And those early experiments were, this is years ago now, but we would mob for 2 to 3 hours in a distributed way, and it was very, very useful and productive. We liked it.
Mm-hmm.
We were always experimenting, so it was like, let's try mobbing, and the results were good. So
nice.
We started bringing it to our customers,
mm-hmm.
and. You know, we've been doing pair programming with our customers for many, many years now.
Yeah.
Mobbing was a different story. So, at one of our largest customers, we were able to get a large screen.
Yeah.
And then another large screen. You know how it goes, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
The large screens are pretty critical to good mobbing.
Yeah.
And the mobbing went so well at one of those customers that, first of all, that team grew.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty soon, one mob was not enough.
Mm-hmm.
So they were able to acquire some more monitors.
Nice.
And within that team space, they now have 3 mobbing stations.
Mm-hmm.
And as a developer in that environment, or tester, or analyst, you can move to different, whatever mob you happen to find the most value.
Nice. Yeah.
So we call that multi-mobbing.
Okay.
And there's a huge Kanban on the wall.
Yeah.
And they're constantly looking at their flow metrics and how they're doing predictions. And however, they're also multi-mobbing.
Yeah.
And so it's a wonderful environment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been replicated around a lot of this large organization.
Nice.
And then we've brought it to many other companies. So
how long has the multi-mob lasted? Like in the longest time frame you have?
I mean, that multi-mob has been going on for more than a year or two.
Okay,
so
awesome.
That's been, it has stuck. And at times, one of the multi-mobbing stations might have just 2 people.
Yeah.
It's sort of like pair programming. But
yep.
Then eventually a third person will show up. Or they'll disband that multi-mob and go to the other 2.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so it's very fluid.
Yes.
Yes.
It's not controlled.
We have very similar dynamics, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't know it was a term, but I've been on a multi-mob for a while, so now I can use that term.
Yeah.
The Joshua Kirievsky stamps multi-mob. That's what I do.
We just had to try to name it because it's not the normal mobbing. There's several mobs.
It's more dynamic. It's a little bit more dynamic. Different numbers of people going in and out.
Yeah. Because we don't always have a 2 pizza team.
Yeah.
That is to say, teams sometimes get a little larger.
Yeah.
And yet they're able to work well together. In that environment.
Nice, so. Awesome. Yeah, we have 2 projects that have 3 mobbing stations, but they don't always stay 3 mobs.
Yeah.
And so, and then it grows and shrinks and depending on complexity and things like that. Yeah.
It's kind of like the law of 2 feet is always at work, right?
Right.
You know, so
that's right.
Yeah, and we've seen it grow more and more. People switch around.
Yeah.
And that's healthy because it's spreading around the knowledge.
So maybe what patterns have you identified in multi-mob environments that would be interesting to our audience?
Yeah, so, you know, if you're one of the most important ones is assessing whether you're really contributing. Uh-huh. And if you're not, then maybe move to another mob.
Yeah.
So that's a really important one. Mm-hmm. It's the self-assessment to know, am I adding value here? Or would I be better served elsewhere? You know, would I help serve people better elsewhere? So that's a really critical one. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We use Mobster by Dylan Kearns. So
we'll put a link in the video.
Yes.
So Mobster has been great, and that, you know, gets us to do regular breaks.
Yeah.
You know, taking breaks, and of course, you know, switching the navigator and the drivers and all that.
Yeah.
So all that's pretty good. You know, the physical environment, you know, is important. So we have some of the mobbing stations are on. You can stand if you want to. So we're not sitting all day. We know that sitting is the new smoking.
Yeah.
So we try to help people not be sitting all day.
Yeah.
And sometimes some people want to sit and some people don't. So. Yeah. You know, you can have two tables set up with big monitors where one table's down and one table's up.
Yep.
So that's a pattern we often see.
We have some of the Vera desks where you can actually pull them up or down, depending on where you want to be.
And person's height, whoever's the driver.
That's important stuff, absolutely.
Yeah, it's worth it. I mean, sometimes you can buy those ones that you press a button and it goes up and down. They've become much cheaper than they used to be, so there's almost no excuse to not have them.
Mm-hmm.
What else? We, you know, I mean, there's still that we're always going to the Kanban and looking at the flow of the cards and applying that to our work.
And that's really helpful, actually, too. And I've noticed in our environment, I'd be interested in how you do it, but in our environment, we have different styles of Kanbans. They've kind of naturally emerged. One of them is an entire kind of backlog area, the to-do area, and then a three doing columns, one for each mob, and then the done area, and it all flows through that. And then on the other similar team, it's the same thing, except they have three separate Kanban boards. And so I found that very fascinating as well.
Yeah.
And so do you have, what dynamics have you seen there?
Well, of course, we encourage the teams to change the Kanban however they like.
Yeah.
However, we typically will have just one Kanban for a team, even if they're multi-mobbing.
Okay.
So they're, you know, just focusing on moving those cards along. And
nice.
We're not so big on like having to put names on each and everything. You know, it just gets too complicated in the multi-mobbing situation. So it's more about the cards moving than it is about who's doing the work. We're not really looking to...
You measure the system, not the individuals.
That's right.
Collective ownership.
That's right. Collective ownership. And the system. Correct. So.
Yeah.
And sometimes in these corporate environments where they've adopted some sort of... you know, electronic tool. Mm-hmm. Someone has the unfortunate job of translating all this into the electronic tool.
That is something that we don't have to live with.
Yeah.
I did have that in a previous place and did not enjoy that role. But
it's almost like a glorified secretary job just to take it from where it is dynamic and put it into this electronic tool.
Sometimes it happens.
So we also look very much at, I mean, this isn't really related to mobbing, but we're looking at forecasting in order to give some decent understanding of where we might end up.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What strategies do you use there? So I know that I'm a big, like, no estimates fan and things along those lines.
Are you sure?
No, not at all. So people that don't like listening to me on that topic, I think it would be good to get a perspective here that
absolutely.
Dive into this. So I'd be interested in your take on it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in terms of like having run a small business for many years now and built software products with it, it's not so much, you're not so concerned about an estimate. You're concerned about how much money is it going to cost.
Mm-hmm.
What's it going to cost for this feature that I need?
Mm-hmm.
I always talk about this one case where we wanted some security put in place to prevent many people from using the same account.
Yeah,
that's where if you're selling software as a service many people are using one account, you're kind of hurting yourself.
Yeah.
So that was a story.
Yeah.
That was a feature request. And when I first raised it in our team, of which I was one of the programmers on the team, but I was also, you know, definitely a product manager of this effort. Mm-hmm. You know, the initial effort estimate was, that's going to take 3 weeks to do that.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's too expensive. You know, we got all these other things to do. What else could we do? And we brainstormed. Mm-hmm. And we bargain hunted, as I call it. Bargain hunting is where you're looking for, you know, high value at low cost.
Yeah.
So I encourage the team to do this because it can lead to better value. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we were brainstorming, and then we found a 3-day version of this story, which wasn't as robust.
Yeah.
However, it was good enough security. Mm-hmm. And so we ended up doing that. But that was driven more by how much investment we wanted to put into the security feature rather than the estimate. Mm-hmm. So these are rough numbers. Like, 3 weeks. Okay, that's a little too much of a rough number for me. So, you know, we're not big into estimates. We're more into... So, I do believe this, though. You know, there's respect for people comes out of the Toyota production system, right? Okay. And sometimes people need to know what might be available at a certain period of time, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. They're going to a trade show, for example.
Oh, yeah.
Or they're doing a big sales, demo that could lead to a lot of business. And so there may end up being some date by which this has to happen.
Yeah, an actual deadline versus like an estimate.
That's right.
You use estimates to try and fit things into that space.
Yes. So this is an actual deadline.
Yeah.
And when you have an actual deadline, you know, what we'd like to do is focus on the most essential, most important work first and get rid of all the bells and whistles. Because those bells and whistles are what kill you and what create all the stress.
Yep.
If you're working on some minor, stupid little thing that's actually not important.
Gold plating or unnecessary something.
Right. So by focusing first and foremost on the essential basic ability that you're trying to give a customer, we end up getting to that finish line almost always.
Yeah.
And you cut out the fat.
Yeah.
So it's usually not that hard to hit a deadline.
Yeah.
Assuming that it's not a crazy ask.
Yeah.
You know.
And right? I mean that's a big thing for me, right? Is having a incentive for the business to stay lean.
Yes.
And in some ways that can be no estimates, in some ways that can be estimates. And I think the harmful stuff is when you create artificial deadlines that have no meaning and make people's lives miserable, right?
That's
the big danger. But when you're talking about delivering and you're talking about staying lean, I think it's very important. And I'm glad that we got to this part of the conversation. We kind of got to that focal point of saying, cut out the fat, deliver often,
thin vertical slices,
continuous delivery, all that stuff. All that stuff's extremely important, and a lot of it is to make people safe, to make people awesome, deliver continuously.
That's right. And I'm a big fan of trunk-based development.
Yeah.
You know, I know it's not popular, but you know
we're fans too.
Yeah. Yes, so I love branch by abstraction.
Yeah.
And I love because this with the thin vertical slices, the sooner you get something into production, the better.
Yes.
Knowing the difference between deploys and releases, so deploying it in production versus releasing it, when it's deployed, it might not be visible, or it might be visible to a small percentage of people, but when it's released, it's really visible. Mm-hmm. And that, too, can be cadenced enough. And it's released, but only a percentage can see it, now a bigger percentage can see it. So much around that, but the trying to hit deadlines and trying to deal with, first of all, there's so many, there's so many features that get built that never get used.
Oh yeah.
I was just saying this in another session earlier today. You know, are we measuring for the people asking us to do the work? Mm-hmm. Are we measuring how often do they hit a home run? Home run would be they asked for a feature that that ended up getting used a ton by the customers and they love it. Versus they asked for a feature that no one ever really used.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so if you know their batting average, because we have data on that, on usage, think about that. You can go, well, you're asking me to do this by a deadline, but fact is, how do we know that this is really vital?
I mean, the batting average might have been low in the past, and now you're, and that has effect on morale too, right? Like, I've been on teams actually in the past. It's kind of funny that you mentioned this, that the team realized maybe 2 years after the feature was released that the feature never actually worked.
Right.
Right? And you're just like, how often does that happen in companies? But I've seen it. I've heard about this story a lot. I've seen it a lot.
And, yeah.
Yeah.
It seems so basic, too. It's like in many, many companies, we're not looking at usage metrics.
Yeah.
We're just not looking at them.
Yeah.
And that's just crazy. You've got to be looking at the usage, because otherwise you just don't know. You're flying blind.
Yeah. Yeah.
So to me, having usage metrics is just, a starting point for being truly agile.
Yeah. And actually, I have a little bit to say on that. I think one thing that people don't realize is that the usage metrics can be very incremental. And so a lot of the times, like, people don't even know that their website's getting hit or something, right? Like, it's like, just copy the one line thing out of Google Analytics and put it in there and then look at it in a month, right? Like,
right.
Like, a lot of people already aren't doing that.
Yeah.
And then instrument small little pieces, like put in events and things like that if you need to do the instrumentation, or do some generic instrumentation next.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It's funny because we've seen, like, oh, hey, is our updater being used for one of our software platforms? And it's like, yeah, by like maybe 25% of the customers. It's like, okay, well, how do we get our service network to actually go out and talk to everybody to make sure that they all update and stay current? And that was a big realization for the product owner. And so that feedback loop actually came back. And that was such a minor amount of instrumentation.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah. Nothing.
And so it's very, very inexpensive to just get started.
Right? Yeah, and one practical experience recently was we, per your influence to the mob that day, we were like, okay, we need to get instrumentation and to get monitoring in. And a week later, we were having a conversation within the company, and it's really hard to argue with data, right? And so that Google Analytics data was key to showing, to helping resolve the discussion we were having. And so it's even when you don't anticipate it, it can be very incredibly useful.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah.
I'm a huge fan of actually having real data. But I think we haven't even gone as far as we could go. Like, there's times when you're looking at, like, you might have a production problem.
Mm-hmm.
And that's in production, right? Production problem, it's causing exceptions, and there's problems in the logs that are piling up.
Yeah.
However, when you look at the code on your developer machine, everything looks fine.
Yeah.
There's no visual indication that there's a problem in production on that line of code right there, or this area of code right there.
Mm-hmm.
I've been talking about this for a while, which is that I don't believe that our code is reflecting what's happening in production too well.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that would bring a lot more awareness. If someone's saying to you, hey, I want you to build this feature, and you say, but look at this software right here. Look at what's happening in production. This is much higher priority to fix.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's also data
that's
not so accessible to us, but would be very helpful in terms of prioritization.
So you're saying, like, you're looking in the IDE and you'll see next to the line of code how often this gets hit in production? Kind of where mine went when you were talking. But
that, or you'd see some icons that would show, exceptions. Like, well, we had 253 exceptions this month right there.
That'd be a beautiful plugin. I think I would really support that. That'd be great.
That's currently, I'm not aware of anything really doing that today.
Yeah,
I've been talking about this for a while. If we're really going to make safety a prerequisite, as we say in modern agile, let's, the other things too are, a code base ages over time.
Yeah.
You could be in a deep, dark area of the code that hasn't been touched forever, right? I would like that code to look old.
Yeah.
I'd like it to be on the background to be parchment.
Like Trello. Trello has the aging cards. I don't know if you've seen that before, but the background slowly becomes parchment.
Right? Yeah. Oh, is that right?
It's one of the power ups that you can use, but I've used it for a very long time. So, like, the cards just slowly turn brown and then have, like, riffling at the edges.
Oh, there you go. Like, well, so, like, why don't we have that in code so we know as we're navigating the code what is old, what is new?
Yeah.
And we can be a little more sensitive to that, when we're coding. So again, making safety prerequisite by knowing more about our code based on data.
Yeah, those are really great ideas.
There's so much. I think when we just stay in as we are and don't keep improving, it's boring. There's a lot more to do. I mean, I'll never forget when they first started, this will date me, but when you used to have the incremental suggestions, so in other words, you've written the name of the object, you hit dot, and then this is all normal stuff today. Yeah. You hit dot and suddenly a little menu pops up and you're typing and it's showing you all the methods for that didn't used to exist.
And still doesn't in some languages.
But when it did, when it first came to bear, when it first came upon, this is fantastic. This is making my life so much better. And it's so basic, but continuing to bring it up in levels. We have to understand we still have relatively immature tools. And treat it that way and say, how can we make that better?
What's the next best thing? What's the next improvement?
So the transition to one of the next topics. First, I was going to do a thanks to you guys at Industrial Logic for the mob programming cheat sheet.
Oh, yes.
It's very helpful.
I've
used it several times.
We'll link to that.
We'll link to that as well. But
We always want to improve it, too. It's on modernedge.org. It's a free download. And we put a lot of effort into it, but it can always be improved. So
nice. Yeah.
Nice to hear.
So one of the topics in there was safety. And it's part of the cheat sheet. So. Mm-hmm. What's your thoughts on mobbing and safety?
Well, I when I look at like software development, I think about risks. Mm-hmm. I think about managing risks. And I think mobbing does a fantastic job of managing risks. Mm-hmm. That's why I really like it. I also love the simplicity of mobbing. So I think, to me, things that are simpler are safer. Fewest moving parts is going to be safer. Right. Imagine a jet engine where there's like lots of parts moving around, and one that was designed to have fewer moving parts. You probably want the safer one with the fewer moving parts in the airplane you're in. Same with processes. You know, if you can simplify the number of processes that are happening, and I think mobbing does that, that simplicity can lead it to be a little safer. So safety and simplicity, I think, go hand in hand. I think, you know, so the big one, of course, is the siloing of knowledge. Mobbing really goes after that nicely and doesn't allow it to happen. Of course, then there's just bringing up folks. So there's a lot of, these days, a lot of, you know, relatively inexperienced programmers who are joining teams. And how do you, if you put them in a cubicle by themselves and give them a book, and, you know, the speed at which they're going to learn is very slow. So we've been seeing this for years with pairing and with mobbing, that they come up so much faster in their skill, their knowledge of the system, their knowledge of the language, the software language, their ability to collaborate better, lots of things improve as they work together.
I have a pretty good story about that, because we had every once in a while we take visitors, and we had a visitor come in and be like, wow, you know, this mob over here looks really young, but they're really good at object-oriented design and refactoring to patterns and all this other stuff. It's like, how long have they been doing this? I'm like, oh, they're the interns. They were just like, really? And then I was like, yeah, they've been here for, you know, 2 or 3 months, and they're refactoring the patterns already. And it's just fascinating, because they'll sit with the teams and mob with them for a while and just get that anecdotal experience, and then they go and mob together on their project, their internship project. And it's like, they're like, I would hire any one of these interns today, right? Yes. So it's just kind of funny.
We actually did. We hired one of your Hunter interns, Jessica. And she's been fantastic. And helping on one of our client engagements for a while now, and doing really well. So
I'm glad to hear.
I can definitely testify to the fact that the environment you have there, Hunter, is one that's rich for learning rapidly.
Awesome.
The skills of being a modern developer. So
cool.
So.
I wanted to transition a little bit quick, because we're running short on time, but one thing that I know that you have maybe a lot more experience with, because you have clients that you go to and then you have to explain mobbing from a financial level, is what are your strategies, patterns noticed about explaining the financial side of mob programming to executives or CEOs or whatever you end up talking to?
They look basically at, a lot of times I have to figure out how much these executives know about software development.
If
they don't know a lot about software development, then I've really got to get into, like, what are the major risks that you encounter? Certain defects can, like, derail you with customers, or you have so many defects you can't even do any of the new stuff you want to do. Technical debt can hurt you. I mean, there's so many things. Knowledge silos can really hurt you if someone leaves.
Yeah.
There's so many risks in software development. We talk about risks and the cost of those risks, the dollar cost of those risks. Just losing an experienced developer is a huge risk. I mean, and it costs a lot. Mm-hmm. Just to replace that knowledge, especially if they're not pairing or mobbing,
yeah.
is very, very expensive.
Yeah.
So I look at it, I talk to them in terms of dollars, mm-hmm. and then I talk to them in terms of how does mobbing make it more less expensive?
Okay.
Right? Yeah. How does it decrease those risks to basically be a better investment?
Mm-hmm.
And then I talk also about the integrity of the developers, which is if you're sitting there and you're not contributing, even if you're, you know, circulating in the mob, but you really don't feel like this is an area where you have much to add,
yeah.
it's okay to leave. It's okay to go do something that's higher value.
And yes.
we teach that to our developers.
Yeah.
So, you know, that tends to help. Yeah. Help them understand.
By extension, they're being financially responsible, which maybe they don't view
that's right.
that software developers as being financially responsible sometimes,
yes.
right?
Yes, and I'm a huge fan of exposing developers to actual budgets
yes.
and to dollars and cents and customer constraints and those types of things. I mean, I think if you ask people to innovate without understanding the constraints,
yeah.
they're going to constantly come up with things that aren't going to be a good fit
because
they don't understand the constraints.
Yeah.
So they must understand the constraints, and money is one of them.
Yeah.
So
I totally agree with that.
Yeah.
What do you always say to our mob? It's when you're talking to the product owner, you're talking about cost of delay. Cost of delay, right?
Yes.
So if you had something today, what would actually bring back the most, right?
Right.
And, yeah.
What would bring the most value?
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right, Josh. It seems you had some questions for us, or at least one question.
One question I have for you is I guess a couple. First off, there are a lot of teams that do a lot of different practices on their agile process. Mobbing seems to remove a lot of those practices, traditional practices.
That's true.
Could you just briefly say what do you not do? What do you no longer have to do because you're mobbing? Maybe is that too big of a question? I don't know.
No, great question. It's good. I don't know. So maybe Austin's perspective would be interesting because I think before and after between transitioning into our organization.
Yeah, where did you come from and what did you used
to do? Yes, so my previous experience was from scratch, agile transformation, and it became a scrum shop, essentially.
Yeah.
Right? And and so one thing that went away for me, so one thing I'm really passionate about is technical excellence, right?
Yeah.
And so we actually did start to experiment with mobbing before I left, but it was at the very beginning stages of that. Mm-hmm. But being in an environment that wasn't mobbing to one that is, was what you were talking about earlier, where the ability for good things to spread around,
mm-hmm.
Anything that you do while you're coding, just spreads so much more rapidly in mobbing.
Yes.
And in a more traditional, isolated environment, it's much harder to make that happen.
Mm-hmm.
It's much more challenging. And so the ease and the naturalness of it, mm-hmm. Is, as opposed to before, it's often felt like I was inflicting my stuff on people,
Right.
But when you're in a mob and, you center, turn, I wasn't always great at that, but where you, once you're part of the team, then you can
Esther
be like,
Derby reference.
Esther Derby reference.
We'll link to that.
Yeah. once you, you're part of the team and you'd be like, hey, why don't we, this method looks a little long or whatever suggestion you have in mind that you see that the team might be lacking, you can throw it out. Let's run an experiment, maybe 5 minutes if you guys don't agree with me. Give me 5 minutes to try this out.
And mm-hmm.
That's a much more natural thing.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that came to mind. Yeah.
Well, and then I think also like the ability, because there's that freedom to discuss and then there's that safety within the team, a lot of like what is not adding value comes up. Right?
Yeah.
And so what I talk to a lot of people about is just this idea of like, what system do you have today that allows bad processes to leave the system?
Mm-hmm.
And usually no one can answer that question, right?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, it just stays around forever. It's like, that's one of the worst spots that anybody can be in, is just saying, how does a bad practice leave your system? And a couple examples that we have just over the years has been, when I first started where I'm working now, it was like, I got this giant specification document. They're like, okay, go ahead and work on it. It's like, I'm just going to go talk to the product owner now. And so that as a process for the entire team went away very quickly. And it was more about collaborating with our product owners and then learning from our customers and things along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
And then it grew even further to this idea of getting meetings together. Like we have one group of mobs that do stand-ups of mobs, but we don't have daily stand-ups in general.
No daily stand-ups, because you're working together all day long.
Yeah, right? A single mob does not have daily stand-ups. And, you know, maybe groups, multi-mob environments might, but if you're rotating people through those. So we have one mob that just randomizes the people every week that work on them, and mm-hmm. so people all have kind of a idea. Mm-hmm. And it even came to, we noticed that when our product owners were available more often, we had less meeting time. When our product owners were available less often, we had more meeting time. And we charted that based on their product owner availability, and then we reported that data back to the company.
Wow, nice. You made it quantitative.
Yeah, exactly. And so we just said total meeting time and usually spent arguing about what the product owner wanted. Based on product owner availability, and we reported that back out, mm-hmm. And so we eliminated this idea of, you know, a week long cycle before we talked to our product owner, or a month long cycle before we talked to our product owner. That went away.
And what about sprints? And, are you?
We're not doing sprints. So it's
continuous flow.
It's just Kanban, pure Kanban, deploy to production. You know, often teams will deploy 2 or 3, 4 times a day to production mm-hmm. for a single mob.
Yep.
So
that's the simplicity too. So no stand-ups, no sprints, no fewer meetings.
Yes.
Especially because if the product owner's in the room with you,
then
you can just have a discussion about any given thing you're working on. Mm-hmm. So then you don't have to have so many sprint planning meetings because you're not sprinting, and you don't have to have the planning meeting at all. You just talk.
And an actual extrapolation of that is all of our management that happens within the group is all done by interest groups within the department.
Yep.
And so we don't have managers per se, except for myself, and I don't really manage. Instead, we basically have what I referred to in the past as homeowners associations, and now we call them League of Extraordinary Interested Individuals.
Not extraordinary, but we are extraordinary.
Yeah, extraordinary. Yeah. what that led to is basically, you know, if people wanted to be involved, they could be more involved. So I do budgeting with developers, like for the department, getting money into the developer size. But people attend optionally. And if a single developer didn't want to be in meetings at all, there's one hour a month of required meetings for mm-hmm. any one developer. So a lot of our developers will spend 7 hours a week on learning time, mm-hmm. and then the rest of the time writing software.
That's great.
And then those who are more interested in changing the process of the department will be involved in those other meetings. And I think one summary after being in both places in recent time was a lot of the spirit of the agile things, of all the ceremonies and that, they still apply. It's just way streamlined. So mm-hmm. you still need to refine your backlog well with the product owner or within your team. You still need to have great discussions and great collaboration and good facilitation. You still, mm-hmm. you know, there still needs to be someone to take on the role informally or formally of facilitation. So all the things you see in a lot of the agile frameworks are there, but it just kind of happens more naturally,
mm-hmm.
and it's just streamlined, and it's just the way we work, as opposed to being a date and time meeting and
like
follow this protocol, you know. And
I feel like it's a feedback loop thing too. So it's like you actually have people that can give you feedback right away.
Yeah.
And if you have strong psychological safety and the team, and feedback flows freely, then all of a sudden every little process that we normally worry about gets there really quick. It gets streamlined.
So it's finer. It's finer grain too.
Yeah.
It's just things are happening in a finer grain process than traditional.
Yeah.
I mean, and
all
for example,
small and safe.
Yeah. For example, we've talked about it a couple times on the show, but previous experience was retrospective as a once every 2 weeks kind of thing meeting. It was kind of felt more formal and those kind of things. And then my current mob has picked up the pattern that started in another mob, which was we retrospect as part of the mob timer.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very often, it's very small,
and
it's much more informal, but found it way more productive.
Continuous retrospection.
Yes.
Yeah, that's definitely a thing.
Yeah. It's like between every 45 minutes or every 4 hours or once a day. Yeah, like those.
A lot
of teams are like that.
Here's another question for you. I can say this sort of in different ways, but obviously you have to start with the traditional process before you can work in an environment like Hunter, right?
Yeah, your whole talk on the training wheels, right? You need a particular framework as training wheels first, and then you got to go through the evolution of the last 15 years, and then you can, you know, do mobbing.
What I'm saying here is I know you've had interns, for example, come straight into the Hunter environment.
Yes.
Never having gone through the two-week sprint and the product owner and the this and that. Yeah. And,
So it's kind of just a little bit funny, but our interns, for example, I feel bad for because sometimes they just move on to another company where we don't have open positions by the time the internship is over. And so they see our environment for, you know, about 3 months, and then they go to another company. And then
you spoil them for life.
Yeah. I hear horror stories that way. Sometimes. But I think the main thing is, like, there's time that we actually have started, because of that, reflecting on that, we've started educating our interns on what the processes are like at other companies before they move on, because we got feedback saying, like, I had no idea what a story point was, and I went into an interview, and they just shut me down right away, and I was like, no! So, I want them to be successful. So, I don't believe that there's any baseline that needs to happen. Mm-hmm. And I'm also a big fan of diffusion of innovation style stuff. Get your early adopters together and support it, run it as an experiment and grow it.
Yeah.
That happened naturally with us, and mm-hmm. then it grew over time, but then it ended up being really awesome, and that was a big thing.
One last question. Have you experimented at all with, having the team own a little more of the product ownership?
That's a complicated question.
We have talked about this. Yeah. This has been interesting.
So, I think a big thing is that we have been heavily involved in the product ownership. Okay. And so,
yeah, I remember you telling me this story.
Yeah, there's a bit of it in the sense that our product owners are also working on physical products and things along those lines. And so a lot of times we end up talking about agile product ownership to our product owners who are more formally involved in product development for physical products.
Yeah.
And so, because we're a manufacturing company and things along those lines. And so a lot of it has been a partnership between software developers and product managers and product owners to make the right thing, right? Mm-hmm. And don't gold plate, don't do all this excessive stuff, and instead go and it's funny because I think I had that exact conversation that you brought up earlier, which was the having to maybe segregate duties to make permissions in an application and how expensive that'll be and everything like this. So we've had that discussion of like, hey, look, this is an extremely complex thing you're asking, and we could get there just by doing this thing instead.
Bargain hunting with that estimate.
Exactly, yeah. Bargain hunting. Same sizing and all that stuff, right? Yes, whatever it ends up being. And I think what we actually do is same size, and then it'll cost to delay the same size.
Yep.
Something along those lines. But what's been really just awesome about it has been that collaborate, that face-to-face communication, and just saying, like, sharing of expertise has been extremely healthy.
Yes.
And that's a big part of when the product owner is not available, it's really damaging to the team, right?
Yeah.
And so if you bring everybody together and set mm-hmm. a path, you can get a lot of really awesome stuff done.
Yeah, and I remember you telling me about people had the ability to do their own little experiments on the product, so they could come up, something like one person you mentioned experimented with something which went on to become an important feature of it. And the product owner didn't ask for it, the developer thought of it.
Yeah. Yes.
I love it when teams enable that kind of thing to happen, where it doesn't all have to come through the one choke point, which is the product owner. It can come from multiple places. That's to me product ownership, where it's a collective. Not to say I'm not discounting product management skill.
Yes.
Got to have that within the team.
Yeah.
However, I'm not a huge fan of the role called product owner, because I think that I like ownership.
Yeah.
Team ownership, mm-hmm. team responsibility together for an awesome outcome. To me, that's a higher level maturity.
Yeah, yeah.
That's where you're trying to get super clear on what are we trying to achieve for the customer?
Yeah.
What's the fastest way with the highest quality to get there as a team? Mm-hmm. How do we pool our collective knowledge to get us there?
Sure.
And of course, that's going to understand things that we don't know yet about the hardware that someone knows.
Yeah.
But it's a pulling together of all this stuff, these constraints to say, oh, what could we do? And that's a collective to me.
And so our relationship with our product owners has been extremely collaborative, and they act as a very vocal customer voice within the team. And we say, okay, they're going to decide on things that we do. We're going to we're gonna consult and talk to them about it. And we're also going to inject our own ideas, and many developer ideas make it into the product owner's backlog. But there's also opportunities for spikes, and there's also opportunities for using the learning session to build something for the team. And then we even have our internships, and then we partner with the local universities to also have them do projects that are outside. And all of that combined has kind of gives forward momentum to those things, those ideas that usually end up dying.
Right? I see. That's exciting.
And I'll share my personal journey a little bit to this question, because it's been really interesting, actually very recent for me. So coming from a traditional Scrum shop, we have a trained product owner, and it's like, oh, I'm playing the tester role in this product owner discussion, and you own the product. And it's been switching to this environment. One realization I've had is, you really got to wear the coach hat with everyone you interact with as much as you can. You're trying to grow. And so when you're interacting with a product owner, you just don't assume that they'll be a good product owner and they'll do everything right. We own the product with them, and that we want to facilitate that discussion to be the best possible outcome.
That's the facilitation you mentioned earlier, how important that is.
Yes, exactly. And it kind of becomes a collective ownership of the mob to not just like delegate, oh, the product owner will decide everything and we're just the feature factory that he pushes into, is that we own the product with them, and they ultimately decide in our current setup.
Yes.
But we own that outcome as well.
Yes.
And we want to have radical candor with them and not just say, oh, you say it, so therefore there it is. But oh, so you say this is the most important, but how does that relate to cost of delay and usage? You know what I mean? If we build this, how many people are actually going to use this?
Right.
To ask those challenging questions in a kind and respectful way.
Yeah.
So for me, that was a big switch coming in the environment.
It's been much healthier.
Big growing learning thing for me. You know.
And so. I think you can start there. You don't have to start with the other with the single product owner dictating everything.
Yeah. Right.
I think even the Scrum people would say that that's what everyone aims for.
Yeah.
So
the feedback.
I think sometimes those titles that make it into the system, right? Like or these trainings in some cases, will end up resulting in people feeling unsafe going outside of the boundary of their title.
Yeah, right? You end up with silos.
And you end up with behaviors that, you know, are basically like, oh no, that's your job, not mine.
Right.
And we all know how that ends up happening, right? And so, and it's really easy to see it when it's happening, but if people feel unsafe to bring it up, it can be a real problem. Yep. But anybody can collaborate. I think I'm reminded of an early story when we first started mobbing. And it was this idea that when we began to see that our bug count was going down, we started thinking about, well, let's start training our testers in software development. Because we could see on the horizon that our bug rate was almost non-existent, and our bug count was decreasing. And so they were only finding the same bugs over and over again. They were not finding it. And then by the time it got to zero, it's like, come join the team of programmers, right? And so, and just the separation of title was causing the people involved so much anxiety.
Yes.
And so these titles that we have do not optimize the system.
Yeah.
They segregate it.
Correct.
Right.
It's like a lean thing, right? Yeah, the general, You're gonna say something.
No, same thing, I was gonna say that. You gotta be a little careful with titles. It's not to say you don't want all those different skills in place. And there's always going to be a few who are going to be the best at it. You have people that have experience in hardware manufacturing for these devices you guys make with water. It's not like a programmer is going to suddenly have those hardware skills. However, they might have a good idea for the product that wasn't thought about by the hardware person.
Yeah, absolutely.
The tester might have a great idea that the software people didn't think about. They don't have to be called a tester anymore. It's a collective team with the appropriate set of skills to produce some awesome outcomes. That to me is really mature, and what we shoot for, rather than being in our siloed little roles.
Awesome.
Close up the session.
Yep.
It's almost part two of this, huh?
We have part one, part two.
Q&A
afterwards.
So thanks for listening to the Mob Mentality Show. Like and subscribe, and it is awesome talking with Joshua here, and hope to do it again someday.
Thank you, Austin and Chris.
All right, have a good one.
Thank you.